And I didn't even make this connection. A friend of mine did. In 89, I wrote a bunch of Star Wars short stories for a role-playing game. One of them involved Boba Fett and IG-88 having a fight in outer space, and Boba Fett blows up IG-88. This is for the role-playing game. For whatever reasons, that story was very popular at Lucasfilm, so they made it into a comic book. They made it into an action figure set with the two bounty hunters in it, and they even made a pop-up book out of it. And my friend Bryant, who is a Star Wars obsessive, said, so you notice that the Mandalorian, like the first, you know, episode, is a Mandalorian in Mandalorian armor and an IG assassin droid sort of side by side with one another and fighting each other. And he was like, that can't be an accident. And the way that the Mandalorian keeps, like, they've repeated concepts from the holiday special. Like, they've talked about Life Day.
Boba Fett has that
tuning fork gun that was only ever seen in the Star Wars holiday special in the animated sequence. And, you know, and my friend was like, look, you created the idea of a story revolving around an IG assassin droid and Boba Fett. And in in the back of someone's mind, when they think about Boba Fett, when they think about Mandalorians, this is part of this Star Wars DNA. This is that little tiny corner. I always compare working on giant licenses to, being a mason on a medieval church, or, you know, being one of Michelangelo's assistants. You didn't paint the whole Sistine Chapel. That one cherub over there in the corner, that's the one thing you contributed.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Gals of Geekdom podcast. I am your host, Crystal Williams. Unfortunately, Eva and Aaron are going to be here this week, but you'll hear them on another episode at some point, I'm certain of it. But today, we have a very special guest, Mr. David Avalon. Hello. How's it going?
Hi. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you in person, too, or at least face-to-face over the internet and through Skype. just maybe since I think this is your first time being on our show.
On your show?
Maybe, yes. So maybe if you want to give a little bit of a rundown of who you are and what you do and fun stuff and anything else you want to bring up.
My name is David Avalone. I'm primarily a comic book writer. I was in the film industry. I still sort of am since 1987. I'm not going to make anybody. I'm not doing math. You can do math if you want. In pretty much every capacity that you can imagine, I always tell people to go look at my IMDb page if they want to be completely confused as to how I've spent my time the last three decades. Ironically, my work in comic books has led to more and better work in film than I ever had before I worked in comic books, which we can talk about later. But I've primarily written I started with a series of Dynamite called Legendary Vampirella, which is like a steampunk universe version of all of their characters, but I wrote the Vampirella book. Then did some pulp characters for them, The Shadow and Doc Savage. Amazingly fun books to write. And then got into, it's kind of my current niche with them, is sort of turning pop culture sex symbols into feminist comic book heroes with Betty Page and Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And aside from the work with Dynamite, I did a Zorro series with American Mythology called Zorro Swords of Hell. And notably, I co-created a comic book series called Drawing Blood with Kevin Eastman, who created the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Wow, prolific work there.
I've only been doing comics since 2014.
You've done a lot in those six years or so.
I was 49 years old when I got my first job writing a comic book. And I recommend highly to anyone completely changing your career in the middle of your life, because it was really revitalizing. And if you take it seriously, which I did, I had watched movies critically with an idea towards being a filmmaker literally since I was 5 or 6 years old. So when I watched a movie, I paid attention to the editing and the cinematography and the direction and the acting and all that. It didn't prevent me from enjoying movies. It just was part of my experience of movies was the experience of always wanting to learn from every movie about filmmaking. I never read comic books that way. I didn't think about page turns. I didn't think about panel design. I didn't think about dialogue balloon. Like, none of that meant anything to me. Because I didn't have any ambition to create them. So I didn't, you know, I'm not a composer. So when I listen to a symphony, I don't spend a lot of time thinking, oh, the bassoons are coming. Like, I process it in a more holistic way without it becoming an atomized, you know, organizational chart in my head.
Right.
So it was 49 years old. I get my first, someone opened a door for me and I was offered this opportunity, and I literally went over to my shelf and started pulling all of the collections down and the graphic novels and going, Watchmen is mostly 9-panel grids. Who knew? I didn't know that. New Frontier is these pages with 3 bold CinemaScope storyboard panels, like almost always. And again, in each case, the artist then breaks it up in a different thing, you know, and then I looked at Chaykin's American Flag. He's got like pages with 30 panels on them because he's doing tiny little cool things. And I hadn't noticed any of that. Like, I had noticed it in the most casual way, but not in that way watching a film. I would go, oh, he's using an overhead shot because it makes the audience feel this, that, and the other thing. Now I was like, oh, so this creates that pattern. So thinking about all that stuff, and I read a bunch of books on the topic of being a comic book writer, and it really, you know, I wanted to succeed at it, and I wanted to take it seriously. I didn't want it to be just I very much didn't want to do just 1 5-issue series for Dynamite and then never work again. I was like, no, I'm going to do this right, and they're going to want to keep hiring me. And, you know, knock wood, they have never not hired me. They do keep throwing things my way and asking me to keep working with them. And, you know, the books I've done for them have been more and more successful over the years, and that's a good thing. And when this airs, it will have been a couple of weeks in the past, but we did a Kickstarter for my latest project through Dynamite, which was it's a satire of the pandemic year called Elvira the Omega Mam, title that my artist Dave Acosta came up with, which I was in love with. I was like, the Omega Woman, the last sex symbol on Earth, what am I going to call this thing? And he was like, the Omega Mam, obviously. I was like, of course. And I worked on the story with Cassandra Peterson, the real Elvira, which she's always an amazing pleasure to work with and so complimentary. And so it's, you know, it's, comic books is not a thing that makes you rich unless you're Neil Gaiman. But, you know, if you work, there's a possibility of eking out a living if you work a lot. So there was a year, 2019 was my biggest year, and I said no to nothing, and I was exhausted at the end of it. But I put out, I think, 20 comics that year. I was proud of that output, and the work didn't suffer, and I'm proud of the work I did.
That's great to hear. It sounds like you've done, I mean, you got some incredible opportunities thrown your way, and I think it sounds like it's based off of your talent and your work ethic as well, in terms of also being a little bit of obvious luck, but luck is a part of everything, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And I guess I wanted to ask, like, because you went from doing film related work into comics. Do you find that both your work in film and your work in comics, like, is one particularly more like satisfying or rewarding than doing the other, or is it more like project by project?
It's project by project, but I will say that film, which was, you know, my first real love as a like, it was vocational to me. It was something that I felt like I needed to do. As much as I loved it, it never loved me back as much as comics have, in the sense that I didn't get to do a lot of projects as a filmmaker yet where I had the creative freedom and the distribution. Like, I have some short films on YouTube that I think are excellent. I made a feature film kickboxing movie in the late 90s, which I will be fine if no one ever sees that movie again. Troma actually currently owns it, and they have it on YouTube. And I've been trying to get them to correct this. The version they have on YouTube is the pre-sound mixed version. It doesn't have any of the musical score. The sound effects are the onset sound effects. Like, literally the guns make the popping sound that the prop guns I bought made. And I don't know how they even ended up with that, but they uploaded the wrong soundtrack to it. So for now, I won't even say the title, so no one will go looking for it. But
I think it's a little too late for that, right?
Yeah, no, it's not impossible. It's not impossible to find this. Dynamite, for all them being a relatively small publisher, and this may be a factor of them being a small publisher, they have given me creative freedom I could only dream of in movies. Even on my very first project, and I've told this story a bunch of times, but it's worth telling. I wrote my very first comic book script ever, and I was very like, I hope this is good. I hope I nailed it. I hope I got everything right. I did something I haven't really done since, where I'm a terrible artist, but I sketched out every page just to make sure the panels worked. Like, does this actually, am I writing things someone can draw, or am I not? And I didn't show them to the artist. I just, like, I didn't want to dictate that. I just wanted to make sure that it would work. And but that's how nervous I was. I hand in the script, week goes by and I haven't heard anything. And I called up a colleague who also works with Dynamite. And I said, and the editor-in-chief over there is a great good friend of mine named Joe Rybant. And I said, I guess Joe hates this script. I haven't heard a word. This is probably the end of my career as a comic book writer. And the friend laughed and said, someone's drawn it already, man. Like, you're done. Like, don't expect notes. I was like, there are no notes. There's no edit. He's like, no, they hired you to write a thing. You wrote the thing. If they hated it, they'd tell you. If they don't tell you anything, that means someone's drawn it. And that turned out to be the case. And it's part of Joe's personality. He's not effusive with praise, but he's the kind of guy, like, when I read an interview with him, he says nicer things about my writing than he has ever said to me personally. I'm like, well, why don't I get that in an email when I hand in a script? Instead, I get thanks received. You know, he's a very terse individual, and he has said perfectly lovely things to me and about my writing, but it's not, he doesn't consider part of the relationship being telling me how awesome I am. I always think of there's an argument between Peggy and Don Draper on AMC on Mad Men, where she says basically the same thing: you never praised my work, you never anything. And he says, that's what the money is for. Like, what do I, and that's sort of the way I feel about Dynamite. Like, I don't get my ego stroked over there, but they do keep hiring me. You know what I mean? They do keep throwing properties at me and saying, can you do this? And then I do them, and then they hire me for another property. So that's better than praise, really. I would rather not be praised and continue to get work, and good work, fulfilling work. And I've been able to, you know, they've given me my choice of artists, particularly since the book started being successful. I've been able to say, no, I'd really like to work with, and the end of that sentence is almost always Dave Acosta. who's been just an incredible creative partner for me. But that's what I'm saying, that the ability to do some fairly outlandish stuff, the last 10 issues of Betty Page I did was a miniseries called Betty Page Unbound, that started off with Nick Barucci, president, CEO of Dynamite, just wanted to do a series where he had an excuse to put Betty on every cover in a costume from a different Dynamite heroine. He wanted Betty as Vampirella, Betty as Red Sonja, Betty as Deja Thoris. And he said, you know, and it doesn't matter to me how you get there. She can be working on a movie, wearing a costume. I just want an excuse to make the covers. Earlier in the season, one of Lovecraft's monsters, Yog-Sothoth, one of the great old ones, one of Cthulhu's buddies, who happens to be a dimensional portal also. That's Yog-Sothoth's thing, is he is the gate and he is the guardian of the gate. And I said, I have a better idea. How about Yog-Sothoth comes back angry and tries to destroy the universe, and Betty Page keeps jumping through dimensional portals, and in one universe she's Vampirella, in one universe she's Red Sonja. And I said, I call this pitch Crisis on Betty's. And they said, great, start writing it. And I was like, really? You're okaying Crisis on Infinite Betty's? Okay. And Crisis on Infinite Betty's I shall write. And the fourth issue of that series, Betty is they didn't actually have a fourth Dynamite heroine they wanted me to use. They just wanted to make sure I got those first three in. John Royals is an incredible cover artist who does a lot, incredible good girl art, incredible pinup art. And he really likes drawing Betty Page as like a variety of characters. He drew her unrelated to what was inside the comic. He's drawn her as a mermaid, as Snow White, as Dorothy Gale, as whatever. He had a cover we had never used of Betty as Tinkerbell flying around in front of a very angry looking Captain Hook. And I said, I kind of want to do Tinkerbell in issue 4. And they're like, yeah, sure, Tinkerbell, whatever. So issue 4 of that series is Tinkerbell versus Cthulhu. And the fact that I got to write a Tinkerbell versus Cthulhu comic is something I will be proud of for the rest of my life. And the trade of that, by the way, interested parties, Betty Page Unbound Volume 1 comes out. It might just be out when this is coming. I know you can pre-order it on Amazon right now. And that collects the first 4 issues of Betty Page Unbound. It also has in it the Halloween special where she meets Yog-Sothoth for the first time. And it has the epilogue where she meets Albert Einstein.
Well, you've heard that, gals audience. You should go out and pre-order and definitely buy this, because David here is super talented.
Well, thank you. Yeah. It was that classic thing. This happens to me a lot with Dynamite. And again, it is the opposite of something that I'll complain about, which is they always book me for a 4-issue miniseries. And in the first 3 miniseries, that was it. One in and out. They didn't sell that well. So just, and then what happened with the first Betty Page series and then with Elvira is around issue 2 or 3, they'd go, you know, maybe start working on an issue 5 and then an issue 6 and then an issue, like, think ahead. We're probably going to, and because it's all about the trade paperback these days, you have to think in units of like, okay, if it's 4 issues, you can fit 5 in a trade. They're probably not going to do a 6-issue set. So you have to sort of think in these blocks of issues and go like, well, if we go past 5, we're probably going to 8 or 10 or 12. So I should have story material ready. I wasn't prepared. I had no idea how to follow up something like Betty Page Unbound because it was so crazy and epic and giant. And I couldn't just – I really didn't want to just stretch it for one issue. That was not something I wanted to do. So I was like, and I got better at this in the previous series too. I was like, I can do a 1-issue standalone epilogue that, like, the story still wraps up in 4, but 5 is sort of an aftermath story. And since she had just been on this tour of the multiversed. You know, she'd been in four parallel universes in four issues. I was like, well, it's 1952. You've just passed through four dimensional gates into four parallel universes. Who in 1952 do you go to talk to explain that experience to you? Albert Einstein dies about a year and a half after that. So I'm like, she should go down. She's in New York City. She should go down the New Jersey Turnpike and visit Princeton and sit with Albert Einstein. And I, you know, and of course, there's a whole spy plot that I brought in. It is a comic book, so there has to be punching, yes, kicking and shooting and whatever. Not always, but I thought it would be fun for her to meet Einstein. And I do a lot of my, on Betty Page in particular, I do a lot of like looking at history books and looking at like what's going on in 1953. What are people thinking about? What's happening? And I try to work that stuff into the story as much as humanly possible. When I did my Doc Savage series and I didn't have a story idea for it, I took out a book that I have that just gives you like a timeline of events in history. I was like, what's going on in the late 30s that Doc Savage might be interested in? And I came across pretty obvious notion, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. And I went, well, there's a, surely Doc Savage is interested in the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. And then, because I like keeping things modern, even when they take place in 1938, instead of it being Doc Savage taking an interest, he has a, in the long history of the character, he has a cousin named Pat Savage, who's also an aviator. So I made it Pat telling him, go look for Amelia Earhart. And to make it a more modern, as modern a comic as I could, it's pretty clear when you read it that Pat is Amelia Earhart's girlfriend. That they were lovers before she vanished. And there's no record of Amelia Earhart being LGBTQ, but she was a libertine for the time. She was very sexually liberated for the late 1930s or even for the early 1930s. And she spent a lot of time building up women and what women can do, and women should be able to do anything. So I was like, what are the odds that she met young, beautiful Pat Savage and fell in love with her, and, you know, et cetera. So I thought that was a good modern touch to put in a, you know, story set before World War II, you know?
Oh yeah. I think, with any sort of historical fiction, or at least fiction that takes place during certain time periods, it's always incredible what writers and creators can come up with in terms of, it's fun to play with the existing real life world, but just twist it in a way where it becomes either more fascinating or more modern or more nuanced than you may have initially thought about for certain things. Sure. Or it's fun to play against type too, you know, just to have someone you think you know very well, but then to just kind of be like, we're going to take this other direction and then make you believe it, but believe it in a way where it's ridiculous at the same time, or it's either better at the same time than true life. So, I mean, like, I love when stories get a chance to take these detours and to play around with real world facts a bit. Sure. It sounds like you've got a chance to have a little bit of fun with that. And you're given enough creative freedom.
One of the things that I thought was funny about it is that there was a divide. I wondered if, you know, Doc Savage, the magazine started in the 1930s. The paperbacks, the magazines were reprinted in the paperback boom in the late 60s, early 70s, which is pretty much the only reason anyone remembers Doc Savage. Everyone who read it in the 30s is pretty much dead now, you know, like it was a very long time ago. And so a lot of the fans of Doc Savage, the few people who really care about the character, are very old men, generally. Wondered if they would be irked by me saying, oh, Doc Savage's sister is cousin is totally bisexual. And I think it flew right over their heads, which was fine. Whereas when I would read reviews by younger comic book people, they took it absolutely in stride. They're like, so Doc Savage goes off to the Pacific looking for his cousin's girlfriend. Like, there was no, like, amazingly, David Avalone is making Amelia Earhart gay. It's like, they didn't care either. So neither side sort of reacted to it. One side, the younger people took it completely in stride. And I think older men, when Doc Savage says, I know you loved her, Pat, probably went, oh, they were great pals. And it's like, you know what? I'm not going to explain it to you if you can't pick it up. You know, like,
right. It's there. You can interpret it for yourself. Yeah. You can take it in any way you can. I'm glad to hear that there wasn't as much complaints from people super upset about it.
If there was, I absolutely didn't hear it. And, you know, at the time, that's like my third series. And I try to be as aggressive with promotion as I possibly can be without being obnoxious. And Doc Savage is a niche character with a very small fan base. And I knew the comic was not going to I knew it wasn't going to fly off the shelves and sell super well. So one of the things I did is I joined Facebook groups that were dedicated to Doc Savage and said, you know, humbly, I submit this is coming out in a month. You guys might be interested in it. So I kind of feel like I would have heard it from those guys. You know what I mean? Ironically, I had written a one-shot Doc Savage that was kind of a what if that they all hated, you know, but it was a year or two earlier and they had forgiven me by this point because they really liked, the series was called Doc Savage Ring of Fire. The title refers to the ring of, geological phenomenon, the Ring of Fire, which is the ring of volcanoes that goes pretty much around the Pacific. From, you know, Mount St. Helens to, you know, volcanoes in Japan to volcanoes in, you know, the archipelago in Alaska and all that. So there's a ring of fire around the Pacific. That's what the title refers to. But yeah, they were very welcoming. And it's the only time I've ever been the guest of honor at a convention. They had a Doc Savage convention in Phoenix, Arizona, and they invited me to come out and speak for a couple of hours. And
wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. It was honestly
very sweet. It was very sweet and funny.
I love hearing about these conventions that come out, and they seem like very niche ones, but from all accounts I've heard, these tend to be very passionate, you know, sometimes even better.
Absolutely. Than like their love is, and this was like, I want to say it was their 20th annual convention. Like, these guys knew each other really, and they were, I think my wife was one of three women in the room. Because just, you know, it comes from the dark ages of fandom. And these guys have been, you know, carrying the torch for decades. And so you come up and you're the guy who's just doing the latest thing, and you treated it with some amount of respect. And, you know, and they were very happy to have me. But yeah, it's like any niche thing is going to have a niche group of fans, but they really love it, you know, and that's, you never, an anecdote I've told before also, but you never look down on the fans. You never condescend to the fans. You never, ever, ever, mock them for loving the things they love, even if they're not the things you love. You know, like, everything is someone's favorite thing. And so much of that has to do with the year you were born. And like, guys just like 5 to 10 years younger than me are obsessed with the Ninja Turtles, G.I. Joe, the TV show, and the G.I. Joe comics Marvel printed in the 80s. And the Transformers. I am just a minute too old for that. And I love the Turtles, but the Turtles I love are the black and white Mirage comics from the 80s that I read. But by the time it was a Saturday morning cartoon, I was not the age where I was watching Saturday morning cartoons. Right. So I don't know that, you know, Kevin Eastman is my business partner, and I don't know that I've ever seen a full episode of the animated Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but he forgives me for that. In fact, it probably helps. Your business partner should not be obsessed with the work you did in the 80s. I think that might be unhealthy to a certain degree.
Yeah, maybe making a business partner with someone who is a fan, you know, of yours may not be the best real working relationship.
Admiration is good. I admire the hell out of Kevin, and his instincts as an artist, the way he has managed what he's been through since he created the Turtles, it's a hell of a long ride. And that's actually what Drawing Blood is, sort of the thing I co-created with him, is a fictionalized version of a comic book creator who has a career similar to his. The character in the book is named Shane Bookman, and he created a comic book that was turned into a multimedia thing called The Radically Rearranged Ronin Ragdolls, which are three cats that are mutants, and they fight crime in Queens, New York, mostly so I could make a bunch of jokes about the New York Mets, because I'm an old Mets fan. And instead of Renaissance painters, they're named after Japanese animation directors, because I wanted to honor the Japanese influence on the Turtles. So the violent one is named Otomo. The thoughtful, philosophical one is named Miyazaki. And the leader of the group is named Tezuka, after the great Tezuka who created Astro Boy. And Tezuka wears Astro Boy, bright red Astro Boy boots. And Miyazaki has Nausicaa's little flying helmet on. And Otomo has a red leather jacket. Like not Tetsuo. I can't remember the name of the main character in Akira.
So Kaneda?
Kaneda.
Is it Kaneda?
Yeah. She's wearing Kaneda's jacket, and the artist, Troy Little, when he designed the costume, you know, Kaneda has the pill on the back of his jacket.
The iconic jacket.
Yeah. Because she's a cat, hers has a salmon nigiri, little piece of salmon sushi is on the back of her jacket. She's a cat. She likes fish, you know.
Right, that makes total sense.
And we created
that sounds awesome.
One of the most joyous things I've ever worked on is Kevin and I decided, after working on Drawing Blood for a while, that it wasn't working that we only understood the ragdolls as an abstract. They're like the Ninja Turtles. These are their names. They're three of them. They're girls. Like, that's sort of all we knew about them. And we decided we had to actually make that comic. So we did make the origin issue, the first issue of the Radically Rearranged Ronin Ragdolls, as sort of like an in-universe prop.
Right.
It's supposed to be from like 1991. The Kickstarter version actually says like copyright 1991 Shane and Paul Bookman in it. And you have to look on the back in very small letters. It says who actually made the book. But we kind of loved... And when we launched the first Kickstarter, we actually kept a pretense that Shane Bookman was a real person that I had met at a comic book convention and had approached Kevin about reprinting the original Shane Bookman Ragdolls comic and about doing a comic about Shane Bookman's life and all that. And a lot of people, what made me feel like we had done our homework and done a good job with the Ragdolls is the number of people who were like, was that really a cartoon in the 90s? Because that sounds really... And I think people just sort of put like, this isn't how we did it, but I think people conflated the Ninja Turtles and maybe the Powerpuff Girls. Like in their heads, they kind of went, yeah, there were three of them and they were girls, but they were like the Ninja. Yeah, that was a thing, right? And we went, no, really, we totally made that up. You're imagining it's real because we convince you that it's real. And I have a Twitter account as Shane Bookman. Shane still tweets all the time.
Oh, nice. Perfect.
has an Instagram account. And, you know, we all use it as promotion. And in Drawing Blood, we did all this, by the way, because as much as the thing is autobiographical, Drawing Blood is autobiographical, we did not want people reading it going, oh, so Shane Bookman is Kevin Eastman, Paul Bookman is... Laird, therefore Frank Forrest must be Dennis Kitchen, and this person is this person and this person, and that's absolutely not how it was written. We're not recreating history in that kind of detail. It's very fictional. So we wanted to create the idea of Shane Bookman as a person who lives in the same world with Kevin Eastman. And there's actually a scene in the fourth issue where they're at New York City Comic Con. And it's a joke about when the Michael Bay Ninja Turtles movie was announced, he gave an interview where he said a lot of dumb shit. And one of the dumb shit things Michael Bay said is that they're not going to be mutated turtles. They're actually going to be aliens. And the fans flipped the fuck out. I don't know if you remember this. But they
I remember this, yeah.
But they deployed Kevin. They paid him to be a consultant on the movie so that he could step forward and say, no. That's not what Michael meant. Misunderstood him. They're definitely going to be mutant turtles. Don't be afraid. And so we did a whole episode. We did an issue of the show that's like that, where our Michael Bay character, who has the very unsubtle character name of Morgan Harbor, says that the rag dolls aren't going to be cats. They're going to be aliens and blah, blah, blah. So it's very much based on that event. But to keep the distance, there's actually a scene where Shane Bookman is going into a panel with Morgan Harbor to clear this all up. And he runs into me and Kevin Eastman and Ben Bishop, who's the artist on Drawing Blood. And Ben, one of my favorite meta jokes ever, is while Kevin is talking to Shane, Ben has a copy of some trade paperback open, and I'm pointing to something on the page. And Ben said, in my mind, you're pointing at this panel. You have the Drawing Blood trade paperback open, and you're going, oh, look, we got to the panel where we meet Shane Bookman. That's this.
It's an Inception sort of situation.
Yeah, it's totally an Inception situation. And probably my favorite line I have ever written in that comic is the Michael Bay character sees Kevin Eastman, walk off. And he says to Shane Bookman, is that who I think it was? And Shane says, yes. And he says, fuck that guy and fuck his fucking turtles. I don't know why that made me so happy to put that in a comic book. I just thought it was right. I don't know. Maybe I'm too pleased.
It's funny. Breaking the fourth wall like that is fun, especially when you're like writing a story that's so essentially. I mean, I think it would be a blast to write something that just completely topples the fourth wall. I'm a aspiring filmmaker, still working towards to making my own projects. Sure. But I'm a writer right now, but I love horror specifically, but I also like it because I love the horror that can find ways of breaking the fourth wall between what you're viewing and what's like reality. So I've dabbled in the concept of making projects where the YouTube channel where I host said video or said horror story is a part of the narrative as well.
Sure.
I kind of am with you and loving the idea that it's just really fun to tear down those walls and kind of make something that way. It's very satisfying.
And to have people, there's that shiver of audiences love it when you let them put two and two together. They love it more than anything if you don't hold their hands and let them figure something out. And I did this right after my father died. I did this web series. It was a very early, probably too early for a web series, 1999. People didn't even have broadband. I couldn't watch my own web series on my own computer. But my father had just passed away, and he did one of his last books introduced me as a character based on me. And my father was a charming, interesting guy, and he acted in a lot of my friends' short films when I was in college and high school and whatever. And so the book my father wrote, the character based on me walks in on the last page. And I said, what if my adaptation of his book is everything that character went through to get to meeting his father in that office. But there's a lot of like flashbacks and news footage, and I used old 16 millimeter black and white films of my dad wearing a fedora with a trench coat on to play this retired private detective from the story.
Oh.
And I did an the second episode of it was supposed to be like an episode of a TV news show telling the story of the life of this private eye named Ed Noon. And I used all this imagery and photographs of my dad. And then at one point the narrator says, in the early 1950s, a friend in the publishing world convinced Ed Noon to write up his case files as fictional novels, and he published them under the pseudonym Michael Avalone. And then there's a picture of my dad that says Michael Avalone under it. And I just love the idea of people who liked the web series Googling Michael Avalone and going, oh my God, this is all real. Like, there really was a Michael Avalone. He really wrote 35 novels about Ed Noon, and there really was some confusion over who Ed Noon was. And none of that's true, but my dad did write the Ed Noon series. But I thought that little extra moment of doubt of Googling Michael Avalone and going to the Wikipedia page and seeing the picture and going, oh, that's the guy from the TV. That's the guy from the web series, you know, and the fact that I was playing his son and all that. So that in horror, I think that frisson of like, is this real, works really well. And even, you know, movies like I always think it's very, very, very underrated movie, but Existenz plays a lot with that, like, what am I seeing and what level of reality I am, and is this even, you know, that last line in that movie is one of those chilling endings of a movie that I can think of, and that plays with that a little bit. But also, you know, in terms of something like Drawing Blood, we knew a lot of people were going to read it and bring their own, what they think they know about Kevin Eastman and what they think they know about the Ninja Turtles and all of that. And we just wanted to subvert that and say, don't try too hard to figure out what parts of Kevin's life this actually is and what part's true and what's parts false. And even with the name, you know, the character, there's a character that's his mentor who becomes his publishing partner who commits suicide in the first issue. So the name of the character is Frank Forrest because he's based somewhat on Wally Wood, who did commit suicide. He was never Kevin's business partner. He's just someone who influenced Kevin. Dennis Kitchen was his actual business partner in a publishing enterprise that famously melted down called Tundra. And we draw the character to look like comic book legend Jim Steranko. He's none of those three people. You know what I mean? But he's intentionally all of those three people so that you don't get hung up on, well, Dennis Kitchen is younger than that and didn't commit suicide and didn't commit fraud or anything like that. So it's just a way of keeping people from being obsessive about the reality of it, which we really want to achieve. I always tell people, especially I was concerned because, you know, Kevin and Peter – you know, famously broke up and stopped working together and all that. Mm-hmm. Kevin only has nice things to say about Peter. For the purposes of drama, there has to be conflict between those two characters. And certainly Kevin and Peter had real, true, important conflicts with one another. But I always tell people, I've never met Peter Laird. I do, however, have a terrible relationship with my sister, and that's what it's based on. Like, if you want the truth of that comic book situation, it's about me and my sister. It's not at all about Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird. Like, that's the relationship I'm drawing on, you know. And to the degree that there are any parallels in those relationships, that's for anyone else to think about. But that's not how it was built, you know.
Right. That's understandable.
This comic, we very much didn't want it to be settling scores, for want of a better word. And it's just, even with Michael Bay, we're not settling a score with Michael Bay. We're pulling his leg. You know what I mean? For the goofy, he gave a goofy press conference. It made everyone miserable. We're making a joke out of that. We're not you know, it's not we hate Michael Bay, he's the worst person in the world. You know, that's not
right.
The point of it is this was a funny fucking story. And when we started working on it, I told Kevin we have to do the Turtles or Aliens thing issue. That real story is too funny not to pass up.
Oh yeah, it's so from what it sounds like, you guys were just attempting to, because with someone like Kevin, he's well known obviously for the Turtles and very looked upon and scrutinized, and I think you guys were just trying to have something fun and just play around with certain things in your lives. But I think it was very, very smart of you to be like, this isn't based specifically on this sort of drama. It's not hashing out drama. It's about having fun with someone's own life and stuff. And if you try to rehash that drama in the comic, I think that story would probably fall apart based on that, right?
That's the thing. Real life always needs to be reorganized into story. Yeah. It very rarely unfolds like story. And also, I kind of feel like every time I've ever read someone's fictionalized story where they were settling scores with people that they were mad at, it becomes really obvious what they're like. It just reads bitter. It reads bitter and sad. And we just didn't want it to feel like that. You know,
it detracts from the story.
The winner, you know, in any conversation about where the story is going and how we're telling it, the winner is always telling the best story, not because you can get so trapped in, but that's not how it happened. It's like, we're not, this is the opposite of a docudrama, you know, and that's why I kind of have a hatred for biopics in movies that just change so many details from reality that there's no. Why did you even like A Beautiful Mind? None of that happened to that guy. Like literally, he was a mathematician. He was paranoid schizophrenic, and he did win the Nobel Prize in math. That is literally the only stuff in that movie that's true. You know, like everything else in it is complete nonsense. And it's one of those things where the real story is 1,000 times more interesting. 1,000 times more interesting.
I've run into some of those movies and stuff where I'm just like, I'd rather be watching a documentary about this person as opposed to like this fictionalized weird drama with some actor trying to recreate reality.
And
you know,
and that's just fraudulent. The thing that amazes me the most is that, you know, Hollywood is imitative, and everyone in Hollywood, you know, well, what was successful? How can I imitate this successful thing? And the movie that tops critics' lists all the time is Citizen Kane. Not a biopic about William Randolph Hearst, a movie about a fictional character that shares some biological DNA with Hearst, that shares some vague life events with Hearst. But it's not a movie about William Randolph Hearst, and that's why it's a great movie. Because it can take
the story
with his life that it wants to, you know, it doesn't, you're not sitting there going, well, but that never happened to Hearst. That's crazy. Why would you put that in this movie? And that's what always blows my mind. When I see a movie like A Beautiful Mind, I'm like, if you want to do this movie, just change the mathematician's name to something else. And then I'm fine. Then I don't feel like you lied to me for 2 hours.
Right.
Born on the 4th of July is the same way. 99% of that stuff didn't happen to Ron Kovic and is there for, you know, fictional purposes. And I'm like, then just make it about a different GI who loses his legs in Vietnam and speaks at the Democratic Convention. Like, doesn't have to be the guy. Like, just change it. Make it a story instead of this nonsense. And so I always err on the side of, except, you know, yes, I used Amelia Earhart in a story that's obviously a science fiction story. I am obviously not making a biopic about Amelia Earhart.
Right. With you're not super, trying to like.
With super villains and death rays and, you know, like, no, obviously this is, you know, that's different from writing, you know, from writing historical fiction that is very obviously and intentionally historical fiction. No one thinks Sigmund Freud met Sherlock Holmes after they watched the movie The 7% Solution. They know it's a Sherlock right, Holmes movie that has Sigmund Freud in it, and that's fun for everyone. But you'd never – don't make a Sigmund Freud movie like that. That would be terrible, you know. So anyway
– you're not putting on – sorry, you're not putting on the pretense that you're making it a reality. It's more like, this is all fiction. It's just for fun.
Yeah.
It's just to call back to real people and to kind of set your character in a frame of mind that works within the universe and the story, that's so that people can understand
a little bit. I think it's partially because I'm on some level a frustrated history teacher that I kind of hate it when people get bad history from movies.
Right. You know?
When they're told something, this is an outright lie about how things happened and how the world works. That
it's
incredibly offensive to me. There's a 4-hour long movie about the outbreak of the Civil War called Gods and Generals. It's terrible. I can say one thing about the movie to explain how terrible it is. It's about the lead up to and the first few battles of the American Civil War. The word slavery is not spoken out loud on screen for the first 2 hours of the film. And I'm like, how does...
Yeah.
No, these guys were talking about that, man. That was the subject. The subject was slavery. We were all talking about it. The idea that you could cover 1860 to 1861 and not have a single character mention slavery out loud because it would offend the heroic vision of Confederate generals you're trying to sell, that's just offensively stupid, you know. And and a certain, you know, if you can't be honest about it, then don't make a movie, you know.
Right, absolutely. I think the last film, kind of like how you have the A Beautiful Mind that frustrates you, the last film that frustrated me like that was Bohemian Rhapsody, just because it was so completely fabricated in so many ways and so offensively fabricated, where things changed about Freddie, and it just, like, I don't know, it felt really weird watching that movie, because, like, there's certain scenes that work really well. You can tell that the filmmaking was good. You got Rami Malek doing a pretty good impersonation of Freddie, the good makeup, good production, and it's, like, almost there.
Yeah,
but it's just felt safe in a lot of ways.
It is that thing where the other band members were alive, and
they were in control of the story.
Yeah, and so you kind of get their version, and you have to go, well, that's the no. It's just I enjoyed it, but I didn't. It was definitely one of those things where it's like, I'm not gonna believe this is anything that happened, though. But I don't know the stories in my bones. It's the same thing with the Elton John movie. I enjoyed it, but I was like, I don't particularly accept that this is a true story of the life of Elton John in any way, shape, or form, you know. And in that one, the way that movie was made, one of the things that kind of bugged me about it is knowing that Elton was the performer and didn't write any of those words, and the songs were portrayed as his internal monologue. And I'm like, no, that was Bernie Taupin's internal monologue. Like, making Elton John's songs be an expression of what was in Elton John's soul, I'm kind of like, but it's Bernie Taupin's soul that wrote all of those words that he's singing. That's not his internal monologue. That's what someone wrote and handed him, and he performed it beautifully. It's like making a movie about Roger Daltrey and pretending all of that came from him when Pete Townsend wrote every word that came out of her. Like, if you made a Roger Daltrey biopic that sidelined Pete Townsend, that would just be weird. I was like, no, this is just his. Pete Townsend was just his supportive buddy. It's like, no, not really at all. That's not at all what happened with those two guys. So, you know, it's one of those where I don't think you can make an Elton John movie that's not 50%. If you're going to make an honest Elton John movie, it has to be like sort of 50% about Bernie Taupin, or you're not telling the story of those songs. For one of them, you know, you're not.
I think I'm a little bit more forgiving of that movie because its intention wasn't really to create the reality of the scenario. It was much more a jukebox musical. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't going, this is a story. It's going, this is a musical that's kind of similar to the story.
And it absolutely trafficked in fantasy. You know, and was a more stylistically, it also wasn't directed by a rapist. So it's also got that going for it. So, yeah. You know, which is always a good.
That's a good plus.
Yeah.
Those two get compared a lot, Bohemian and Rocket Man, but I always prefer Rocket Man.
Yeah. No, and even though the director of Rocket Man is the one who took over Bohemian Rhapsody and finished it, but they came out about the same time. They're both about, you know, 70s, 80s rock icons and all that.
Yeah.
So it's understandable. But yeah, they couldn't be more different in some ways.
No, they're not. They're very different. Yeah. I also love stories that you mentioned where they play with historical figures, you know, like you've written. I even love Forrest Gump for that. I mean, it's a fictional story, but it intertwines with history, and it hits those marks of it, like, well, this is happening at this moment. And sometimes it was like actors portraying the exact moments on screen, but sometimes it was small personal moments where they handled it really well and sort of subtly at times, where it wasn't like too, I mean, it's obviously in your face about it, but at the same time, it's not where it's like someone going in going, I'm this person, you know, right. Like loudly.
Well, they did that thing. It's one of those things where I bet you could do it better, a lot better today, special effects wise.
Oh yeah.
You know, manipulating the, you know, the real footage of people and all that, but
an actor's face too. Yeah. They could do that, but that's always led to, if you don't have the production, that leads to some uncanny valley sort of scenarios.
But we've gotten so much better at that. I've seen some deep fake stuff that I really enjoyed on YouTube of like putting Harrison Ford's face on Alden Ehrenreich's performance.
I saw that.
And
yeah.
Solo, and the same thing with Chris Pine and William Shatner. And one of the things that my wife pointed out when we were watching is it works because Ehrenreich and Pine both did a really good job imitating the other actor's physicality, how they stand and how they gesture and they talk. So it doesn't look like a weird ass disconnect. I've seen others where it didn't work at all because you're like, that actor wasn't doing a good impression and it didn't really, you know, I thought that was. I remember reading an interview with Pine where he said, he said, what I imitated about William Shatner is how he moves, because he has this Shakespearean stage actor balletic quality to his movement, even in Star Trek. And he's like, so that's what I mostly was imitating, was Shatner's physicality. And I think Ehrenreich did the same thing. You know, how you stand and how you hold your body and all that. But
yeah, I enjoy the you mentioned the Abrams Star Trek. I actually really enjoy it. And I think a part of that is because when I'm watching those films, I feel like I'm watching those characters. I'm not like looking for how well are they portraying the original actor's interpretation of this role.
I definitely,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I've definitely said this before, but I'm not of that I am not the "you ruined my childhood" fan. I am not. I have frequently said that, you know, despite what I was promised on Twitter, Chris Pine did not come to my home and shred my William Shatner DVDs. And we're all very disappointed about that in this house. We were hoping he and Zachary Quinto would show up and throw my Star Trek the Motion Picture VHS tape in the fire, you know, just as an act of, but no, that stuff is still there. The stuff from my childhood has not changed one bit. I can enjoy it. You know, Pierce Brosnan did not drive Sean Connery out of my house either. It's not, there's no, my childhood cannot be ruined. There's a great quote from Raymond Chandler that I always think of. Late in his life, an interviewer asked him, how do you feel about what Hollywood has done to your books? And he said, Hollywood, my books are right over there. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, Hollywood has done literally nothing to my books. My books are unchanged. You can get them in hardcover. You can get them in paperback. They're still my books. Like, Humphrey Bogart doesn't affect my books at all. And I feel that way about art in general. Now, you know, I'm a lifelong James Bond fan, and I hated Spectre with the heat of a million suns. And when I walked out of it, I turned to my wife and said, you know, they can stop making these now. I'm fine. I have all the Bond movies I need. I'm good. We have the box set. We can watch Diamonds Are Forever whenever we like. It's fine. We can watch Goldfinger. But that doesn't mean I won't give them another try when No Time to Die comes out. The director is someone that I think is a very good director, so I have high hopes for it. But my point is, like, it doesn't set anything on fire. And it's this weird thing, the sequelitis thing. There's this childish, keep giving me the thing that I like over and over again. But the problem is, it's like any drug. Like, how many times can you, like, it's got to change. You got to up the dosage. Something's got to evolve. Or eventually,
diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a joke I've made before, but I always say at conventions, like, I should whisper this because I would love to work for Marvel and DC and make Marvel and DC money, but I'd rather write Betty Page than Batman, and I'd rather write Elvira than Spider-Man, because you know what? They're not burned out. They are not overused. I got a million stories I can tell with those characters that have never been told before. I can tell them in a unique way. And, you know, if Joe Quesada called me tomorrow and said, you're taking over Fantastic Four, I would be thrilled for the opportunity. I would, within 2 or 3 weeks, come up with a pitch that I loved and was super excited to write. But as soon as I hung up the phone, I'd be like, oh, I guess they fight Dr. Doom again or something. I guess Galactus could come back. The Ultimate Nullifier. It's just, I'm bored with it. I'm bored. Right. You know, Tom King's a great writer. I don't care about Batman. No one can make me care about Batman. I've been seeing Batman. Batman's older than I am, and I've seen any number of his adventures that I enjoy. And show me the Joker, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm so fucking bored. I never need to see the Joker again in my entire. All due respect to Mark Hamill, I never need to see the Joker again in my life. Now we watched the Harley Quinn satire, the Harley Quinn series on DC Universe. I fucking love that. That may be my favorite Bat thing maybe ever, because it's funny and it's smart and it takes the Bat universe and does completely unexpected things with it and takes idiotic characters like Kite Man and makes them intrinsically important. It takes the dumbest characters in the Bat universe and uses them in a funny and convincing way. We also love Diedrich Bader. He's my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
As a comedy Batman, I put him above Will Arnett because he's not all joke. Diedrich Bader could do a completely serious Batman and be fine, but he's just funny enough in the context of that show. But that's such a different take on the material.
Right. It's so drastically different. It's unique.
We watched that show, and at the same time we were watching one of the DC Universe animated movies. I think it was one. I'm a huge Jack Kirby fan. Mm-hmm. So there was one that was about Apocalypse and Darkseid and all that. And they had I think it was Tony Todd. It was someone great playing Darkseid. The writers of the sitcom got Darkseid better than the writers of the series. Like, in the sitcom, they had him launch off on some weird ass existentialist, you know, rumination. And I went, that's Jack Kirby. Jack Kirby's Darkseid is not Darth Vader. He's a guy that has a sense of humor and is a philosopher and will stand around saying weird shit all the time. That's Jack Kirby wrote Darkseid as a guy that he shows up, he busts up Mr. Miracle and Big Barda's wedding in the original comics. And everybody runs away from Darkseid. And the two sidekicks, Shiloh and Oberon, are left around. And they're like, oh my God, it's Darkseid. And he says, Darkseid says, the ceremony was brief but full of real emotion. But life at best is bittersweet. Life at best is bittersweet. That's what the supervillain says to, and that's the last episode of the last issue of the original series. And I just, whenever, when you write Darkseid, you got to remember he's the guy saying life at best is bittersweet. That he's a weirdo. That he's a chatty weirdo. And the writers of the sitcom ran with Darkseid, chatty weirdo. And in the straight cartoon, in the straight animated epic, he was just a boring Thanos. And it's funny because Thanos is, of course, a ripoff of Darkseid, not the other way around. And I shouldn't say ripoff. I love Jim Starlin. Thanos is Jim Starlin's tribute to Jack Kirby and his attempt to do the Jack Kirby cosmic universe at Marvel. And it shows how badly DC manages its properties and its movies, that when Darkseid finally shows up in the Snyder cut, more than half of America that watches that movie is going to go, oh, that's just some Thanos ripoff. That's just some Darth Vader Thanos ripoff. When literally Darth Vader and Thanos are ripoffs of Darkseid. Darkseid's the original model that everyone's kind of, anyway. But it's just all that to say, it's, you should own all of those classic superheroes are great and I love them and everybody should stop writing them unless they have a new idea.
You know what? I couldn't agree more.
Cancel.
I like the new tanks.
Cancel all those books, and when some genius writer, Mark Waid, has a Superman idea, great. Great. Do it. Kurt Busiek wants to do Fantat, great. Let him do it. Like, you know, Bendis has something for Spider-Man, great. Some up-and-comer has something, great. But just the sheer, like, we have to keep putting this out every month because we put it out every month. I so don't care. And it also, it's why the industry struggles. Mm-hmm. Because if you're young and you want to start reading Batman comic books, where do you start? What's the first thing you read? Now? Like, they have such a hard time creating jump-in points for any of those characters. You know, and without jumping, you don't get new readers, and those books don't really get new readers.
I think that's what the problem is when you start to cater to your older fan base, like, too much, where you forget to do things that are more daring or unique. And I'm sure that the people who write some of these films and comics, they love the characters and care, but if it's the same, it's going to be the same. You have to do something unique. I think it's why, in terms of TV shows, like you mentioned, I, out of DC, I love seeing Harley Quinn show, and I love seeing Doom Patrol, because no one has done, I mean, there was comics of Doom Patrol, but we hadn't seen a live-action Doom Patrol, and that show is just kind of like, you know, a breath of fresh air. It's like, it doesn't need to be completely dark.
Yeah.
You know,
and they're strip mining the best stuff from Morrison's run, you know, while still using Rita Farr, who Morrison never really used in those comics at all. But she's an interesting character, so they left her in. I mean, I think it's interesting that when you do it right, I can honestly say that I'm a big fan of Brubaker. The Winter Soldier run on the original Captain America, when I hated those comics. They did not entertain me. I started reading Captain America because I was a Brubaker fan. And about 8 issues in, I'm like, I couldn't care less about this. And I hated Civil War, hated the comics, thought they were terrible, badly written comics that did not entertain me. I love both those movies. Like, I love what the screenwriters did with the Winter Soldier idea. I love what they did with the Civil War idea. I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was a good storytelling. And I think that's, man, that's turn lame comics into great movies. I think that's better than turning great comics into lame movies. Like, go take the story ideas. And that's what's so amazing, is the comic book industry has created a zillion story ideas since the 1930s. And for the longest time, they made superhero movies that just complete, they didn't bother to look at the comics and go, what's in here? How can we, what can we find in here? And I love that in this new age where we actually try to acknowledge the original creators, I love now watching a Marvel or DC show and freezing the thing where it says Elektra by, Frank Miller.
Right.
And
yes. By this artist, yeah.
King Shark created by, the fact that you have to go, okay, well, this, you need 30, all this licensed material, all this company owned material. Yeah. The character of Thanos as seen in the movies is based on the work of about, it's initially Jim Starlin, but 20 guys have written Thanos since Jim Starlin, 100 people have written it. And each little bit invisibly contributes to that. And one of mine, I say with limited humility, and I didn't even make this connection, a friend of mine did. In 89, I wrote a bunch of Star Wars short stories for a role-playing game. One of them involved Boba Fett and IG-88 having a fight in outer space, and Boba Fett blows up IG-88. This is for the role-playing game. For whatever reasons, that story was very popular at Lucasfilm. So they made it into a comic book. They made it into an action figure set with the two bounty hunters in it. And they even made a pop-up book out of it. And my friend Bryant, who is a Star Wars obsessive, said, so you notice that the Mandalorian, like the first, episode is a Mandalorian in Mandalorian armor and an IG assassin droid sort of side by side with one another and fighting each other. And he was like, that can't be an accident. And the way that the Mandalorian keeps, like, they've repeated concepts from the holiday special. Like, they've talked about Life Day.
Yeah.
Boba Fett has that tuning fork gun that was only ever seen in the Star Wars holiday special in the animated sequence. And, and my friend was like, look, you created the idea of a story revolving around an IG assassin droid and Boba Fett. And in the back of someone's mind, when they think about Boba Fett, when they think about Mandalorians, this is part of this Star Wars DNA. This is that little tiny corner. I always compare working on giant licenses to, being a mason on a medieval church, or, being one of Michelangelo's assistants. You didn't paint the whole Sistine Chapel. That one cherub over there in the corner, that's the one thing you contributed. Like, that's it. And sort of Boba Fett versus IG-88 is my cornice, my little corner of this unbelievably massive, beloved tapestry. But the other people that love that tapestry, the season premiere of Mandalorian drew a bunch of stuff that people told me was only in the games. And I said, okay, so they're definitely drawing from the role-playing games and from the video games the show. So they are doing all of that research. So it tickles me to think that on some genetic level, someone associated Mandalorian and IG Assassin Droid and went, let's do that. Let's do that on the Mandalorian. And that's the thing that you can't, when you work on these giant structures that are owned by corporations and a thousand artisans over literally 40, 50 years of history, 70, 80 years, are all, you can't trace every piece of that DNA. Someone might put a line in an issue of Batman that's something they remember from a Denny O'Neill comic from 1972, and it might be one line of dialogue, it might be one idea, it might be one panel. I see that sometimes. I see a panel, I'm like, that's a Jack Kirby panel from a 1970s comic that clearly this artist loved and they wanted to put it in thing. Kevin Eastman showed me he did a Turtles cover a few years ago that he was really proud of. And he said, stare at it for a while. And I went, oh, that's that great Kirby Thor cover. You have, you know, Raphael is in the same pose with his weapon that Thor was in that Jack Kirby cover. And he just, when they introduced the new turtle, Jenica, he recreated one of the first or second Jack Kirby Hulk cover with Jenica turning into a turtle. And that kind of, like I said, you can't trace all of that DNA. You can't escape it. We are all of us composed of our influences and really the degree to which we succeed or fail as artists, not succeed or fail as business people, but as artists, is how successfully we recapitulate those influences without engaging in mere imitation. You take the influence and you make something different and new, but people go, oh, that's in one of my favorite things I've ever written in the Cthulhu versus Tinkerbell thing. You know, Peter Pan says at one point, to die would be an awfully big adventure in the original Peter Pan. And I had a moment where grown up Peter Pan, who's kind of haggard and a little bit past it, is in the throne room of the great old ones on Rillette, surrounded by giant interdimensional monsters. And he's got a machine gun and he pulls back the bolt on the machine gun and goes, to die would be an awfully big adventure. And opens fire on the suicidally opening fire on a room full of kaiju, essentially, with a single machine gun. And that echo, I think Eva even called our interview this, that echo of, you don't want to be imitating. What you want to be using is what William Burroughs called mythic resonance, where the thing, there are only 27 stories, and when you tell one of those 27 stories and you have a scene from one of those 27 stories, you want it to, it echoes through all of those other stories where you go, the satisfaction is the feeling of that echo and that way in which that thing that you're evoking, to die would be an awfully big adventure in this case, is a human thing, is part of the human experience, is part of human culture, and you are reflecting it. You're not stealing it. You're reflecting it. If you're just repeating it. Again, it's the difference between a joke on The Simpsons and a joke on Family Guy. You know, on Family Guy, they literally think just recreating something. You know, they did those Star Wars knockoff episodes, and there were like two or three good jokes in them. But mostly it was just the animators of Family Guy recreating shots from Star Wars for no comedic effect, except, oh, it's that shot from Star Wars. That's not enough. What did you bring to it? What did you change from it? What did you milk from it? That's the job.
Right. That's so you're the entire point. And I think what wraps up this whole show very well is, to find ways to, maybe we can't avoid understanding and honoring the past, but we have to find new ways of doing that and to bring something new and bring some energy to the table.
Something personal. If your work is just, well, I saw this in a comic book once, or I saw this in a movie once, that's ultimately a hollow experience. You have to bring your human, like, you know, what I said earlier about my relationship with my sister versus Kevin's relationship with Peter Laird. I'm not writing about conflict between people as I have seen it in movies and comic books. I'm writing about conflict between people as I have understood it in my lived human life. And I think you can kind of, the hollowness of some art. It's easy to write a 20-page superhero story. There is a formula. If nothing in those 20 pages resonates with human life, no one cares. No one ultimately will care. You know, for all that it's written like a soap opera, Chris Claremont's Dark Phoenix saga is about losing someone you love and is about sacrifice. And it's about people being afraid of the darkness. Like there are real human things at play beyond simply, so she turns into a god and she's bad and then she kills herself. Like, you know, there has to be more to it than that, you know, and it's as a perfect example, there's an irony to, for me, to the fact that both the second season of Doom Patrol and the first season of Umbrella Academy are the Dark Phoenix saga. They're variations yes. on it. They're yeah. better than the Dark Phoenix saga movie made with the actual X-Men in it. And that's a funny thing.
Right.
What if your lover, your sister, your best friend had this turned evil and or not in the case of Doom Patrol, wasn't even evil, but had this ability to destroy the world and had to control it. And how would you deal with that? And I think, like I said, it's funny to me that the knockoffs of the Dark Phoenix saga expressed the emotion of that story 1,000 times better than the official version of it.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It seems like they, I think what you're saying, it seemed like there was just a lot of care and personal connection brought into those, which make those work so much better than a corporate trying to necessarily use a property before they couldn't, essentially. That, right. I mean, that's what X-Men was. Right. So yeah. I would love to talk with you for hours on end because this has been really fascinating. Yeah, so I think with this point, this is a perfect time to wrap up. I know at the top of the show I accidentally mispronounced your name.
Oh,
I said Avalon. It's Avalone. Apologize about that. But as we're wrapping up, is there anything that you would like to promote?
The easiest thing is check out my website, which is davidavaloneyfreelance.com. The best thing, you know, growing up having an unusual name was not pleasant. But in the age of Google, the first 10 pages of Google about David Avalone are all me. So that's very helpful. If my name was John Smith, I would be unfindable. But yeah, davidavalonefreelance.com. I post news and what I've got going on and what I'm working on is always available there.
Well, perfect. Then listeners, please go and check out all the information. Follow him on Twitter, obviously. And go to the website. It's the best place where you can get everything. My name is Crystal Williams. You can follow me at Crystal W. Rocks on Twitter. And you can also read my writing. But I'm also one of our regular hosts for the show. And I'm sure next time we'll have the rest of everybody to have another fun episode for you. But this has been another great episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, David.
My pleasure.
Thank you, and we will see you all next time.